Well, hey there, and welcome to episode number 58 of Groove, the No Treble podcast, which you can always find at notreble.com. My name is Mitch Joel. Let's get on with the show. So who are you and what do you do?
I am James Lomenzo. I've been playing bass for over 30 years, professionally and otherwise, and I travel the world and try to make people happy as well as myself.
It's really amazing to connect with you, James. Thanks so much for doing this.
Well, after all these years, it's nice to see you again. Mitch was kind enough to send me an old photo from backstage where we both looked like we were about 12 to 14. And I'm not going to say who the older gentleman was, but back from when I had my first tour with White Lion and came through Montreal.
Yeah, it's a funny thing because I have, like, in all of the years that I was doing rock music journalism, which was like actually more than 10 plus years, I didn't really do that all that often with pictures and autographs and passes. I have like one folder. And so when your name sort of came across the radar and I was super interested in talking to you, I was like, I got to go find this photo album. And I found it. So I scanned it and sent it to you this morning. And I have to say, I know you're being very kind. You really have an age. You look amazing. I look at those two pictures and I don't even recognize who they are.
Oh, you haven't seen me this morning, Mitch. You're too kind. Thank you.
But so what's amazing is you're like, I've been playing professionally for 30 plus years, and I did the quick math on the photo, and that photo was basically 30 plus years ago.
Yes, there we go. So, well, the plus is a sliding scale. It has to do with my memory concerns at this point.
Yeah. Well, but it's an amazing thing for me because obviously me having that picture is a signal, and the signal is that I had a longstanding career in rock journalism, and my real passion at the time was really hard rock music. And I mean, I got into some of the earlier bands that I really loved. One of them was White Lion. Like, in fact, I remember it being released on Atlantic and it not being released at the same time in Canada, and me literally doing cross-border shopping. And
I love
up,
that.
Yeah, and I picked up the Pride album and I listened to it the whole hour drive back and fell in love with it and thought it was great. And then that sort of sets you on a course, if you like the bass, to follow the players that you liked. And I loved your playing. And we're going to talk about the sort of dynamics of your career because it's one of the most, I think, one of the more fascinating career stories in rock that maybe a lot of people haven't heard. But I'm really curious about this idea. Like when I was thinking about talking with you, I wrote down just this note that said, you're really a rock guy who has changed his spots quite a bit and still you stayed within the rock genre.
Well, that's accurate, I think. I mean, I have to digress all the way to being just a little kid, not really knowing that I wanted to be a musician. My 5 or 6 years old, I was aware somehow that I wanted to, like, you know, little kids can be kind of show-offy, you know, and I was one of those kids. I used to like to kind of, like, what did I have? We had TV back in the 60s when I was a kid. So, you know, mom would drop you there for a little while she took care of the house or something like that, and that was kind of, you know, my view into the world as being a little kid. And what did I see? I saw like talk show hosts and, you know, game show hosts. But there's something I recognized in these people. And that was that they were able to speak en masse to me through the TV and to these big audiences. And I was drawn to that kind of weird expectation of like, well, I'd like to do that. You know, I would like to, you know, exude. What I can see that is now looking back is that I had this inside, you know, I had this internal need to be artistically heard. So the funny thing is I thought maybe I want to be a talk show host when I grow up, like 5 or 6 years old, right? And then my dad used to play records for us all the time. He's a frustrated he never did play trumpet, but he always wanted to be a trumpet player like Harry James. He actually had a beautiful singing voice, by the way. So he used to share music with my brothers and I at a very early age. And so he would just mix it up. He would, you know, he'd put on like Tchaikovsky, and then he'd put on like all these Italian crooners like Jimmy Roselli and Jerry Vale. And somewhere around the mid 60s, you know, the Beatles came along, and my brother had bought the Meet the Beatles record. And so he used to just put that in the stack along with Frank Sinatra and everything else. And I thought that was really kind of cool in a way that my dad was like, you know, kind of reinforced this notion that my dad was so into music, it didn't matter. So when I started getting older, you know, I started to kind of like, well, I want to be a drummer. I want to make music. That's the vehicle that I need. That's the thing I want to use to communicate to people, to let my inner self out. And so, you know, it started me wanting to be a drummer and then kind of moving into guitar and moving into bass.
So talk to me a little bit, and again, we're going to go through the sort of some of the gore details of it, because you've played and been around some fascinating people. But I'm really curious about, like, when I think of mountaintops in your career, I think of obviously about White Lion, I think about Megadeth, I think about you playing with Black Label Society, and then I would jump to John Fogerty. You've done a lot in the middle, and we'll talk about that. But that's more of what I meant. Like, you've been really malleable within the genre, like from classic to hard rock to heavy, not grungy, but sort of heavy sludgy stuff with Zach, to acoustic stuff with Zach, to Megadeth. Like you've been very malleable in that.
Well, going back to my dissertation that I just
we like that. That's why
laid
we do
on
this
your
show.
Doorstep there. That was the point. I was exposed to so much music. In the 60s, radio, like there was AM radio, FM was just kind of on the, you know, on the outskirts of coming in. So the playlist on AM radio back then was Ray Charles, and it was Frank Sinatra, and then it was any pop song you could think of. And then it, you know, it was, you know, so there's this amalgam of music just hitting me from all ends, including rock and roll. And rock and roll naturally was the most appealing to me because it was the most, you know, it was the most visceral. It was the most caveman-like. It what excited me about rock and roll when I first heard it was you could hear a person singing. It didn't sound like Frankie Valli anymore. You know, it didn't sound like somebody singing like that. You know, it sounded like a real person in the room emoting. So I was indoctrinated with a lot of styles at a very early age before I could even disseminate what they meant or what they were or how those sounds were made. When I got into junior high school, we had to take different musical instruments. I was playing guitar at the time, and the teacher held up the French horn. And he said, "This one's really hard." And I was really arrogant at that point. And I said, "I want to play that." So I played French horn throughout high school, junior high school, and into a couple of weeks worth of college. And so I got to understand how orchestras worked. My point is, Mitch, that all the music to me was always just music. You know, it was just different gradients of the same id, you know. So style didn't matter. I love the aggression because I was young enough to really want to exude, you know, when I was younger. And that's why rock and roll appealed to me. And that's why I've always said, okay, go ahead.
No, go, please go.
Well, I've always, what I say now, and this is all in retrospect, I can figure this stuff out now a lot easier than I could 20, 30 years ago. But, you know, I have an aptitude for heavy music because I've done so much of it, and that's kind of where my path took me. But my love is still, you know, it's still R&B, it's still rhythm and blues, it's still the old 50s stuff. It is still orchestration, and it's pop music just straight ahead, just for its form alone. I love popular music, and I just like the way it's kind of constructed for the masses and easy to grab onto. And the stuff I grew up, which was pop music in the 60s, was, you know, it was like silly little songs that would come on the radio and come and go, you know. Why do you build me up, buttercup? They all had a kind of a sound to them, you know, and that's kind of where I started my exploration. So getting to John Fogerty, that's where I started. Those are the first songs I ever played when I was 11 years old, like live. I would play what was on the radio. What was on the radio were two Creedence songs, Who'll Stop the Rain and Traveling Band. Those are the ones I could learn pretty quick.
Okay, so there's sort of three buckets there that I want to attack. Let's start with the last one. So let's talk a little bit about John Fogerty, its current situation. It's funny, I didn't really know that you were playing with him. I was very aware that Kenny Aronoff, the drummer, was playing with him. I recently actually saw Kenny at the NAMM show. He was playing. Great. He was the house band actually for the Gibson private party. The bass player was Daryl Jones with him, which was also a killer combo.
Wonderful.
And I know you guys do a lot of stuff together. So that 2013 has been with John Fogerty. Is that on or off, or has that been consistent since 2000?
No, I've been with him. I've been with him for it's 5 years now, I guess. Right. So I've been throughout. I mean, I'm considered his bass player, as is Kenny his drummer.
And so talk a bit about that. I mean, you sort of make this leap of like, yeah, I grew up and I'm listening to Creedence Clearwater Revival. But this is, to me, like when people like you say stories like this to me, I sort of put the brakes on. I'm like, can we just stop for a second? Like, is it insane that you are 11, 12 years old listening to music that you are now in the person's band? Like, I can't even fathom what that must be like.
Okay, I'm going to send you a picture when we're done. Unfortunately, the audience won't see it. And it's a picture from a backyard with laundry hanging behind me, wearing a denim jacket and having John Fogerty's exact haircut. Not because I was trying, just because at the same time our hair was growing out, if you know what I mean. I'm 11 years old. He's obviously 20 or 21. But anyway, my mind was officially blown when he decided to choose me as his bass player. John's a very delineated fellow, as a lot of people might know. And, you know, he's an older guy now, and I guess they were changing up the band. Kenny Aronoff was playing in a jam situation. I'd met Kenny on a session one time, and he impressed me so much because I felt he was a kindred spirit with me in that he showed up at the session with way too much stuff and like really trying to help the session and the music move along. He was there strictly for the music, you know, as opposed to watching his watch and, you know, figuring out where the next gig was. And I'm like that too. So I latched onto him. We started playing these jam nights that I put together in Burbank. He just happened to be off. I brazenly asked him to be the drummer on that. And he graciously accepted. And we became kind of a real good rhythm section together just by doing that every week. Nothing but fun, nothing but covers. We had all our famous friends come down. It was really terrific. And so So Kenny's way, like, you know, he's doing like weekend gigs and, you know, midweek gigs with John. And I see them on The Tonight Show. And it was John's last album that he had put out. And he was doing an original song, a newer song. And I remember the bass player was right up front by the camera, just happened to be that way. And this was like this kind of, you know, Allman Brothers kind of major six riffy thing. The bass player was just flying all over the thing. And I thought, what a wonderful player. You know, so I couldn't wait to see Kenny next week when we were going to play together and tell him what I thought. And so I said, man, that guy's terrific. And he goes, yeah, well, he's not in the band anymore. You know, they're just changing people up. And so I sheepishly said to him, you know, I would love to play with John Fogerty and you. And he goes, I know, I told him. And, you know, I guess they kind of looked you up and thought, well, you know, he's a heavy metal guy, maybe not best for what we're doing right now. And so, you know, I'm just guessing. I don't know, really know the reason. But and so I just said, OK, fine, I understand that. And so a week later, Kenny says, we auditioned a bunch of guys today. There was one guy who played kind of like you do, but he didn't have quite as much, I thought. So I actually told John, I said, you really should give James a listen. And a couple of days later, I got a call from John's brother who handles things and said, you know, we'd love you to come down and audition. So there I was at a rehearsal place just outside with 11 other guys. And, you know, they all came in groups of three. It was all timed out throughout the day. And some of the guys used to come to the jam session I had, you know. So I was like, hey, it's you. Great. And I sat out there and I listened. You know, it was pretty loud. And I could hear the bleat of the guys auditioning. And everybody sounded great, Mitch. Everybody. I mean, I'm sitting out there and going, how's he going to choose, you know? So I get in there. I mean, so it's a much longer, more involved story, but I'll just keep it shorter for this podcast. But so I go in there, and John was very gracious. Come on up. You got everything you need. So I get up there, and I'm ready to play. And I remembered an article I had done for Bass Player Magazine where I was just trying to share the tribal knowledge for some of my bass playing friends out there and tell them, you know, I drew this imaginary story about what it would be like to audition for a hero. In that case, it was Sting. It never happened to me, but I thought, what would that be like? And so, you know, that was kind of rolling in my head as I was doing it. So there we were, starting going through some of the songs that I had prepared. And I remembered what I had said in the article. And one of the things I said was, not to crowd the artist, but to walk towards him confidently and actually try and make music with him and show him that, you know, you're capable of standing there with him and, you know, you're in the moment musically. And so I did that, not even reluctantly. I was excited to be in that room with the guy. And so we played through some songs and then we're playing Down on the Corner and Kenny's giving me the eyes like, go to the mic, you should be singing. You know, and I jumped to the mic and sang and I sang along with him and that was it. And a couple of days later, I got the call and they made an offer for me to be part of the band and my head was officially exploding at that point.
Did he mention the fact that you confidently walked over to him? Did he sort of feel the presence too?
The thing he told me was, and this was months later. I mean, I didn't prod for anything, but he turned to me one time and he goes, you know, I got to say, you know, we looked at all these bass players, but you were demonstrably what I was looking for. You know, and I, from what I know about myself and what I kind of know about John, I think he really likes that in the moment energy. I think it has to be there for him because he really exudes that and he lives on that.
You talked earlier about your father, the instruments he played, what was happening in the home. And then you sort of traced over this reality that you actually didn't just go to college to study music. You went to Brooklyn College of Music that you got into playing the French horn.
Right. I got some money for it, so it made sense.
But I'm just curious, what were your parents like super proud of you? Like, was your dad like, this is amazing because like that, again, like I was playing a horned instrument. Like was he like, oh God, don't do this.
No, my dad was the reason I'm speaking to you right now about my career is that my dad could never have been. I don't know too many people's parents who've been more supportive than mine. My dad did everything he could. He really did want to be, you know, he really wants to be a musician, you know, from his perspective. His dad was a first generation Italian who moved here and opened up a shoe store through connections and all that. And so my grandfather, my dad's dad, expected my dad to sit in the shoe store for the rest of his life. And my dad, you know, my dad wanted to play baseball and, you know, all the great things that America had to offer, you know, growing up there. And so he was somewhat frustrated, you know. And so he, you know, after my grandfather had passed away, you know, it was his opportunity to do something else. He loved woodworking. So he went and did that. He became a carpenter and, you know, went and worked on construction and eventually became a foreman, et cetera. But he took well care of us. And the thing was, even though he was doing all that, he would come home at night when I had my band of like 12 and 13 year olds. By the way, Steve Ogieri, anybody out there might know him from singing in Journey for many years.
Yeah, Tall Stories.
Then Tall Stories. Great. Mitch, you're right on this. Great. He was a neighborhood guy that I went to school with, and we started our first band together. And so he was one of the guys in my basement every night. My dad and mom would put up with the noise, and, you know, my dad would rent the van and help us move the PA and get us to the gigs and act as our manager and stuff like that. That's how supportive he was.
But it sounds that you sort of did this French horn Brooklyn College music thing. It feels, maybe I'm wrong, just somewhat begrudgingly, like you didn't really want to be.
Yes, no, I got out of it as quickly as I could. I loved playing French horn. You know, I wish I could do it right now. It would take me another year to get back on that train. But I was very good at it. I would get the first chair spots. I had a lot of great opportunities, and going to Brooklyn College was one of them. But I saw this as being a bigger gamble than what I really thought I could do. And that was actually, I really became enamored by the bass guitar at this point. And you have to understand, at this moment in time, it's mid-70s, we'd just gone through the early 70s. To me, the bass guitar was like a superstar instrument. The producers would push it up front in the mixes. There's Chris Squire, all these amazing Geddy Lee, as you'd mentioned. I can go on and on, but Stanley Clark, Jaco Pastorius, there was all these superstars playing this instrument and pushing the boundaries of this thing. And it intrigued the shit out of me. I couldn't wait to get better on the thing. So I just kept working on that. So I worked on that while I did French horn. As a matter of fact, I even put together a band eventually in high school, just before college, of eight of us, I'm the trombone player, trumpet player, all that. And we did songs from the Who's Quadrophenian. We did songs from Chicago, you know, all these bits, not the play, but the band Chicago back then. And we'd actually sneak into school, into the school during lunch concerts, just so we could do that kind of thing. So I was still like, I'm playing bass guitar in this band with horns, charting all the music out for them. So again, to me, it was all music, you know, I wasn't really, you know, but I was really committed to this bass guitar thing. And, you know, I said it for a while when my career was kind of faltering. Sometimes I would go, like an asshole, I decided to be a bass player. I could have just been a French horn player and found a good seat, you know.
What's so interesting, though, is you're talking about timing, and then you mentioned the Who Quadrophenian. When I was reading your story and getting ready for this, and again, there's not, you know, beyond your own bio on your website, this sort of real story of you, there's a lot of stuff on you, but the story, there's sort of some holes for me, and that's why I'm so fascinated by these conversations. But I thought French horn, bass, 70s, my brain immediately went to John Entwistle, because he was a French horn player, too.
As I was getting better at the bass, he became a huge inspiration because you couldn't really hear him very good on those records, not like you think you would, right? I mean, you can, but I mean, that amazing tone that he developed live. When I finally started seeing some live stuff, and I think I saw The Kids Are All Right in the theater, that's when my head exploded. I was like, it can sound like that. You can be the other guitar player in the band. That changed my life in a way. And so I did not pick French horn because he was playing it. I just happened to be playing French horn and found out he played it. And so the hairs on the back of my neck all went up once that realization came. And I said, well, I could be like that guy. I mean, certainly not as big and broad, but I could certainly be as obnoxious, I think.
Yeah. You mentioned Steve Ogieri, and again, I was a big fan of that first Tall Stories album, and then I actually saw him live many times when he did his tenure in Journey in the post Steve Perry world. And I was thinking about like how I wanted to approach that part of the conversation with you, only because I find it interesting that you have this strange career where you get involved with people like that who went on to other things and connections to other major bands. And I always marvel at that. Like, what an amazing, I don't know if it's luck, just geographic, just what it is, but you have a career where those types of moments from the very early part of your music career really, like, it carries through all through your music career, these like friendships and relationships with people who then go on to do crazy things.
You know what, I put it, now that we understand more about comedians and their social lives and their struggle and all that, because there's a lot of TV shows and information about that now, which never used to be, because they became rock stars throughout the late 80s and into the 90s. It's not dissimilar. I mean, it's not dissimilar to that. These people were all driven like I was. So, we were somehow just drawn together. When I met Steve, we were in that that class when the teacher held up the French horn. And he picked the saxophone, and we kind of looked at each other, maybe like two outlaws, you know, like sizing each other up, because we were the guys who were keenly interested in making music. And, Steve was playing guitar back then, and we were both on that kind of same path. So I honestly think it's nothing more than that. I think it's just the luck of place, obviously, but it's just the recognition that somebody else has that same drive and desire that you do. And I think you gravitate towards people like that.
When you first hear him open his mouth, are you like, oh my God, this guy is unbelievable? I mean, it seems like he's one of many, but few, who are just so talented and gifted.
He just released an album and came on my feed on Facebook. And I listened to one of the songs he's promoting. And it blew me away. And I commented immediately. I mean, just out of the clear blue, and put my little face and my name, in a little response place, and just told him, man, thank God that there are people with your voice and your talent still out there doing it. And, I beg everyone out there to go listen to his new record, because he's just amazing. But and he's always been there.
Was he like that? Like, I have a couple friends from my high school or college years where it's like in the music circle where, the guy would sing of, and you're like, you're just going to be famous. Like, there's just no, was he
no,
like that?
No, I thought I was the better singer. Honestly, we were little kids. We didn't know what the hell we were doing. So I thought, oh, well, I'll be the lead singer. And then he started saying, okay, you can sing some too. Yeah.
I was talking, like you mentioned, I very recently and very happily had a conversation with Geddy Lee. And I was talking to him, and it's a question I love asking people like you, which is, when did you first really feel that the bass was your path? Like, you're holding your hands, you've played with it a bit, and you sort of realize, like, now this is going to be my career. And Geddy made a comment that was like, he was like, playing bass is kind of like being the goalie on the hockey team. It's like you're sort of just given it. Like, it's because somebody pointed at you and said, well, you're now playing bass. It's very rarely the first sort of stop. Like, nobody wakes up and goes, I want to be a goalie on the hockey team. And I thought it was a funny analogy, because it is very rare over the short history of this instrument that you meet someone who is like, no, they only played the bass. And going through your history from French horn to playing guitar first. But I am curious, when you were really focused on the bass, and at what point you were like, No, this instrument is me, and what your memories are of that time.
Okay. So first thing, I started playing drums. My parents wisely said, no, you should try another instrument, because I was probably driving them crazy, And I imagine I would have been a good drummer. We had no place legitimately to make that kind of noise. So I went to guitar and I was, basically it was a vehicle for me to sing. I had a really great voice as a young guy, because, before my voice had changed over, I could limitlessly sing anything with passion, kind of like a Michael Jackson kind of vibe. I certainly never had that kind of talent, but, I was somewhere in that neighborhood as a kid, So I went to a summer camp, and they had all these, it was for musicians and artists and people who want to be in plays and stuff. The place is still operating out there. It's in New York. It's infamous. It's called French Woods. I think Maroon 5 went there as a band, and they got famous after that. And there's actresses, Zoe Deschantel went there. I went there the first year they opened up because that teacher who held up the French horn started that place. So Steve Augieri went there as well. And the magic of that place was it really was not set up correctly. Like they were just figuring it out as they went. It was just two music teachers from two different schools who pooled their money in and decided this was something they were going to do. But at that place was the first time I ever experienced a bass guitar. So I'd gone up there singing songs on the radio. And they were, you know, I figured one of the things I would do is I would start a rock band up there because, that's what I felt like doing. I was playing guitar up there. And I heard this bass guitar, and it was billowing all over the camp. And I didn't know where it was coming from, but I localized it to the rehearsal spot. And there's this guy named Gene who's sitting there with his legs up, looked like Keith Richards to me. Probably not, but in my recollection, that's what I thought he looked like. And he's playing one of those EVO basses, you know, the one with the big fat pickup and the little one by the bridge. And I'd never really focused on this as an instrument. You know, I didn't really consider it. I was so guitar-driven. And so he was playing it. I loved the sound of it. I loved the way it filled all that space. And he goes, oh, it's a bass guitar, man. Check it out. So I played it, and I started fingering that thing. And I thought, this is fun, man. This takes up space. It's got that element of rhythm that I wanted to do with the drums. I could still back my vocal up with this. And that's what I was looking at. I'm going to back my vocal up with this. I should digress. Prior to that, the year earlier, my cousin was all about Hendrix, you got to see this Hendrix. It's amazing, you know. And I said, yeah, I know Purple Haze. He goes, no, you have no idea, you know. So we went to go see the Woodstock movie. And I remember watching Jimi Hendrix play and me thinking I was a guitar player and watching what he was doing and having no idea what it was. And really being terrified by the notion of I can never be that good. What is that, you know? And so I had that in my mind before I went to the summer camp. And I was playing the French horn, doing other things, and I was singing. So all those things came together to make me decide. I just, you know what? I'm just going to commit to this, and I'm going to be a singer. And so it was like an afterthought of like, I'm not going to deal with being the best guitar player in the world because I don't know how to do that. I could be a really good bass player, and I could be a really great singer. And I could start a band and do it that way. And then from there, as I started listening, this is the changeover. I started hearing Stanley Clarke, and I started hearing, I mean, that's a little later, but I started hearing people like Chris Squire and all of that. And I didn't recognize it as a bass sound, but when I did, I thought, this thing is way more limitless than I thought. This is intriguing. So I just went on this journey. I became absolutely obsessed, as I'm sure most of your listeners are.
So I'm super curious also about time and location. So what happens is as you do that, you move into this very unique moment in time, which is the early 80s or pre-early 80s, and metal, hair rock, hard rock, whatever people want to call it. Again, one of my most favorite genres of all time. And people typically, when they hear that, go, yeah, LA, Sunset Strip, and the Roxy, and Gazzari's, and all that. But what was happening on the East Coast just so happens, again, that you are coming into your own at this moment in time, is the area in which you live in Brooklyn has this bar called L'Amour's. And that becomes also as infamous on the East Coast, or at least to people who are outside of either of those regions, as being a ground zero for this type of music as well. And here you are where, from my understanding of the story, is you're there, but then you jet out to LA and you actually go back to that area. And I'm just curious because, again, most of us didn't have a chance to live it yet, alone live it as a rock star in that moment. What was that like for you? Like, what was that Brooklyn L'Amour's scene like? People talk about it with so much reverence and love.
It was a moment in time. It's another moment in time. I can say my experience is different than other people's experiences, but I can tell you that the people who used to go there to see bands, I mean, it's mind-blowing to have bands like Motley Crue and Iron Maiden come in there, sometimes just to hang out, you know, not always to perform. Yngwie Malmsteen. I saw Talis there. My brother plays bass as well, and he's my younger brother. And, you know, he was just getting a grip on things. And he said, you know, you got to go see this Talis band. The bass player is just amazing. Billy Sheehan, I'm talking about. And I said, all right, I will next time they're in there. And so I went in there, and he goes, my brother said, you know, he plays just like you do. And I was like, oh, great. Okay, well, I have to see this. So I went to go see Billy. And My brother really loved me because as I watched this demonstration of pyrotechnics all up and down the guy's neck, I was like, yeah, okay. I had that Jimi Hendrix feeling again that I just spoke about, but this time I was kind of armed and dangerous. I was like, I'll take that challenge. You know, I kind of felt like I was moving in that direction. But the thing about moving away from there, I was in a band with Bobby Rondinelli and who else? His brother, and name's flying out of my head right now. But anyway, we had a band, and Felix Pappalardi was in that band just before me. And his wife shot him. He died, you know. And so they were looking for a bass player to replace him. At the time, Jeff Fentholz was the singer, come to think of it. And so I went and I auditioned, and I got that gig. And so we had this band, and we were playing all over the tri-state area. We played in Lemoore. And the guys who managed the club also managed White Lion. And so we played a show. And after I played there, they came up to me and they said, you know, you're a really good bass player. This band that we're managing, White Lion, needs a guy like you. And I had already made a plan just to go to L.A. and see which way the wind blew. Because I'd been out there a couple of years earlier with another band. And, you know, I liked living out there. And I thought maybe I can crack this nut if I go back with a different kind of way of doing it. But anyway, so I told the guys, well, let me take a look at White Lion. When are they going to play? Let me see. They said, well, they're playing in a couple of weeks. So I said, great, come down. So I went down to Lemoore to see White Lion play. And the club was packed. I mean, they had a lot of people there to see them. And they started playing. And I watched. And I thought they were great. But I thought they were just like Van Halen. I mean, you know, Mike Tramp was jumping around, festooned and all that flailing clothing. And Vito was kind of just, you know, he's playing all that great tapping and over-the-hand stuff. They had a great drummer, Nicky Capozzi, who was playing very John Bonham-ish. But I thought to myself, I was like, I don't know where these guys are going to go. I mean, we've already got like this great Van Halen band. Like, I don't see another place to put these guys. And so with that, I basically said, thanks, no thanks, I'm going to take off, but thank you for thinking about me. And I took off. And as I'm out there in L.A., long story short, I become a motorcycle messenger. On the way to work one day, I get into an accident, and it wasn't terrifically horrible, but my bike was out of commission, and I cut my knee, et cetera, and I was out of work. So I run into a friend of mine over at the Rainbow, and his name was John. He was from Brooklyn as well. And, you know, he's going, what are you doing? I said, man, I'm kind of hitting dire straits right now, running out of money, can't work, you know. And he goes, well, why don't you go see about that White Lion band? I said, they still need a bass player? He goes, yeah, they just went through another one. So I said, nah, man, they're like Van Halen. I don't know. He goes, well, you don't look like you have too many options. Why don't you just go, you know? So I said, all right, I'll give him a call. So I gave them a call. My, you know, my folks lived in their home there, so I was close to that. Excuse me a second. I've got a leak here.
I got the dogs. It's good.
Yeah. okay.
No worries.
So, just had to put her in the basement. Now she's perfect. Good. So anyway, so I go, you know, so I call them up, and they send me a plane ticket. And I went to the rehearsal down there in the basement of Lemoore. And there's Vito and there's Mike. And Mike was very gracious. And Vito was a little guarded. They had a new drummer, Greg D'Angelo, who used to take lessons from Bobby Rondinelli, by the way, when I was over there. And so, you know, I didn't know what to think. But they started playing through some music. And I thought, this is kind of cool. This is like that pop music I was telling you about. It was popular music. It didn't feel like heavy metal. And it seemed creative. And I started singing along with Mike and coming up with ideas for vocals and things like that. And they really loved that. And so, you know, as that day went on, I started really warming up to this because it didn't seem like Van Halen at all. And so, you know, they were like, well, we love you. We want you to join the band. We're going to Germany in a couple of months and we're going to do a record. And it was the stuff that we were working on that day. And I was like, wow, okay, I've never been there. Let's go. So it was, I hate to say it, but it was a very matter-of-fact sort of agreement I made with that band because I didn't really trust it at first. But as we all got together and started making music together, it started making a lot of sense to me. And I really endeared it. And, you know, I fell in love with Mike as just, you know, not a front man, but just a really good guy, you know, who's really passionate about what he was doing, as was Vito and as was Greg. And so we went out there and it took off.
But that, you know, you just said it took off. I mean, the truth is that it really did take off. I mean, it became Fast and Furious very, very fast. I mean, bands would kill to have that sort of moment and then album and then just go.
But do you know what that was like for me? That was, I had no idea what was going on. I mean, honestly, I had no idea. We were touring in the early 80s, in the mid 80s. And so that meant, you know, we were staying at really, you know, cheap hotels. And so they didn't have cable in hotels back then. Most of them didn't. You know, some of them had rabbit ears. Some of them just had local networks and stuff. So I wasn't seeing MTV or any of that stuff at all. And so I get occasional phone calls from the family. They, you know, and they'd say, "Wow, you're all over TV. We see you all the time." And it was weird because we had no concept of that. We'd already done the videos, but, you know, we thought that was that. And then slowly, but you know, surely but slowly, the club started filling up, and they started putting us on bigger venues. And then they started pairing us up with giant acts like Aerosmith and AC/DC and bands like that.
Crazy. So there's a couple names that you talked about that I want to touch briefly on. One is when you talked about Ron Dinelli. Again, you talk about people who've had a huge impact on my life. One of them was Ray Gillen, pre-Badlands, who...
Ray Gillen was the singer in the Ron Dinelli band eventually after, you know, after a while. And he was... What?
Did you play with him, though, at the same time?
I shared a room with him. Are you kidding? He's a wonderful guy.
Yeah, he unfortunately passed away, but one of the greatest and I think most underrated bands was Badlands to me of that time too. It's just he was an incredible phenom to me.
He was amazing. I have a very good story about that, by the way, if you want to give me a moment to move to that one.
Yeah, please go.
Okay. So White Lion's moving ahead, right? And so now we make our way all the way out to California, and I'm staying with a girlfriend of mine out there. And I run into Ray in the clubs. Now, this is post-Ron Dinelli, obviously. And, "James, how you doing? How are you doing, Ray?" He goes, "Oh, dude, we need a bass player, man, bad." I said, "Well, I'm in this White Lion band, you know." And he goes, "Well, you know, I'm playing with Jakey Lee and, you know."
It was Eric Singer, probably.
Eric Singer, thank you. And he goes, "You got to come down." And I, again, like I said, I didn't know what was going on with White Lion, whether they're taking off, but I really just wanted to play with these guys. So I said, "Yeah, let me check it out. I mean, I was in town. Why not?" Right. So I go down to the rehearsal place at Mates, and it was a small room. And I remember Eric Singer was on this giant platform in this room, like a Kiss sized platform, as if it should be that way. And Jake was in there playing with some weird non-defined distortion pedal. And, you know, so I crowd around and get all the way to the side, and we start just jamming on some big open notes and stuff. And I can't hear a damn thing that Jakey's playing because the sound is so weird. And I can't make eye contact with Eric. And so for the most part, it was pretty weird, you know, and Ray's just singing his heart out there. So I was thinking, I guess this is okay. I don't know. So anyway, I made a deal with Ray. I said, I'll come down if you'll drop me off at the airport. That was the only thing. So we finish up a couple of jam things and stuff. And I go to the little bathroom in the corner and stuff. And Ray bursts open the door and he goes, "Jakey loves you. Come on, man. You got to join." And I said, "Well, I'll think about it." I, you know, I was just saying that. But and could you close the door? You know. So anyway, and this is God's honest truth, Mitch. So I politely, "Hey, Jakey, this has been great. I'll think about it. Eric, great." I get in the car, he turns on the radio, and Wait comes on the radio. First time I'd ever heard it on the radio. Mm-hmm. And I turned to Ray and I said, "Yeah, man, take me to the airport. I'm not joining your band."
Which is like, it's, I mean, one is, I'm sort of glad you didn't, because I think Greg Chazin was an amazing
player.
Greg is
great. Yeah, yes, great absolutely. Player. Yeah, yeah. No, I wouldn't.
It's so like, I don't know if the world would have had Greg had you taken that gig. So that's a good thing. And again, like, you know, if I'm going back to the story you were talking earlier about seeing Billy Sheehan in Talis, this is sort of also like the stuff that makes my head spin, because eventually you go on in the late 90s and actually join David Lee Roth's band, which is a crazy gig, just because David Lee Roth coming off of Van Halen, it was Billy Sheehan on bass and Steve Vai on guitar and Greg Bissonette on drum. He really put together a band to almost force fans to go, like, check out these players if you thought the guys in Van Halen were good. And then in some strange sort of full circle, you wind up being in David Lee Roth's band too. You have a lot of these weird connections in your life. It's crazy to me.
I can't even plan this stuff. I tell you the truth. I stand in front, I do clinics. And so I'll stand in front of a room full of 50 kids or 100 kids. And the question they always ask is, how do I get to do what you do? And I just basically say, get really prepared, get really good, keep your eyes open, and good luck, because I have no idea how this happens.
Yeah.
But I think we can put it to the universe. People like to put things to the universe. I think if you keep sending those messages out that you really, really, really want this, anything. It doesn't have to be just playing bass guitar. You could be anything. I think that it provides, I think the balance of nature is what it is. We are energy after all. I believe that, you know, so there's something to that because it wasn't, I was talking to somebody recently, Elliot Rubinson, who's a fine bass player. He had bought the Hamer company. Yeah. Hamer. Yeah. No, is that the right company I'm thinking about?
Hamer is the guitar bass company, but I don't.
Yeah,
don't,
right, right. Yeah. So he'd bought that, and he was I saw him at a NAMM show, and he said, "Come on back," and we were having a party at my hotel room and stuff. And so it was drinks and a bunch of people and just conversation, kind of like an artist's party. Let's just talk about stuff. And at that particular time, this is maybe about 7 years ago or so, he started rattling off this itinerary of things that I'd done. He knew more about my stuff than I did, almost like we're talking right now, you know, just kind of threw the stuff out at me. And it was the first time that I'd heard it or put it in perspective, because up until that point, I kept looking forward. What do I do next? What do I do next? And he just slowed me down as a bass player and I wouldn't say, I don't know if it's a fan, but just, you know, interested party. He just started putting all this stuff. And I that's the first time I started looking at this thing in connections like we're talking about. Yeah. And it was startling to me because, again, I wasn't really keeping score. I just kept moving ahead, you know.
So those who don't know the story, there's two other mountaintops that I'm trying to get us to. It's 40 minutes, and I feel like we're just getting started here. Talk to me about what I think is another very important part of your life and important evolution in your style and how you play, which is the meeting of Zach Wilde. And again, me not really making the connections back then, but being a fan, I can just tell you, and I'm sure we'll get into part of the story of that, but I thought Book of Shadows to this day was still one of the best albums. I love that album, listen to it all the time. Zach Wilde's coming off of, you know, crazy tour playing with Ozzy Osbourne, and he goes through this Pride and Glory thing. He goes into this acoustic thing. He then turns this into Black Label Society, which for those who don't know, the only way I would explain Black Label Society is it's basically a motorcycle gang that plays music. Talk a bit about that, because again, if you're just to sort of zoom out 40,000 feet and go, okay, so like this is the guy from Lemora's Brooklyn, White Lion. I remember even hearing that you were the bass player for Black Label Society and going like, I now have to go back and trace like what James Lomenzo was up to. So how did you meet Zach, and how big of a profound change was it for you as a player and pushing the genre?
Zach was the kindred spirit, the guy I'd been looking for all my life. And in that music, certainly musically, if not, you know, personally, I saw him on tour. And, you know, Greg used to be really good at this stuff, D'Angelo. He used to, like, he'd go, we got to keep an eye on this guy. He's really good. Maybe we can do something with him, you know, that kind of thing. And I was the polar opposite of that. I was going, I don't care, you know, like, let's, you know, he seems like a nice guy, whatever. So while we were on tour, you know, him and I just kind of hit it off together. Just how you doing? I mean, he's like that. He's a very gracious human being. I started realizing it was so much about music for Zach, more so than anything else. And so when we talk backstage and stuff, we talk about the stuff we like, the kind of music we grew up on, and we were, you know, kind of meeting in the middle there. So after a couple of weeks on tour with Ozzy, Zach was like, hey, there's a club close by. We can get up there and jam. What do you say? And I said, I'm in. Let's go. And so when we went to this particular place, Greg came as well. We basically, I mean, this is when I saw Zach, who he really was, jumps on stage and just takes the instrument out of the guy's hands. But they willingly gave it to him because they recognized who he was. And so we followed suit and started playing. And once we started playing, I realized that this guy was the guy I've been looking for all my life, because there were no boundaries to what he would do musically. And it was all spontaneous and in the moment, which is something that I'd always had, but I hadn't had a lot of players to play with. It was something that I'd grown up on loving, that stuff that Cream used to do, where you'd play a verse and a chorus and then take it out, you know. And so when we started to do that, we made it like almost a nightly thing on the road. Like if there was a club close by, we'd find out if there were any bands in there and then beg them for their instruments and go. And so from that, when we got back to L.A. and we both had some time down, we just started hanging out and doing pretty much the same. We started this jam band called Leonard Skinhead, which is supposed to sound funny, not evil. But
yeah, yeah. I was going to say, like, in 2019, it's the most inappropriate name, but back then it was
yeah, yeah, exactly correct, right? But it was just because it sounded funnier than Leonard Skinnerd. And we went and started playing, like, all the local clubs in L.A., and naturally, because we had enough clout behind our names, you know, the club owners were thrilled, so it gave us a vehicle. We'd play 3 or 4 hours sometimes. We'd just start there, take a break. We wouldn't even stop because we'd have drinks on stage. We'd just keep playing on through, and people loved it. Like, they'd watch it like it was a trapeze act. They'd wait for us to fall off the, you know, fall off the thing. But, you know, we didn't. You know, we just keep jamming and doing the next song and coming up with stuff we didn't know and finding ways to make it happen. So it went from that into becoming a legitimate thing. When Geffen came around and wanted to sign Zach, he had signed this thing, and we called it Pride and Glory. And that's when Brian Tichy came into it. And we went ahead and we recorded that album. And that album, actually, I run into a lot of musicians, bass players and otherwise, who really think that's a formidable album to them. And it's a formulative album to them.
Yeah, great album.
Like, they got a lot from that record. And I understand why, because that was, even in that time, we were really just getting in a room and playing the songs, like, together. There's something that we did in making those records that was fully organic. And, you know, by hook or by crook. And so after that, I'd gone and played with, we toured on that for a little while. Geffen wasn't interested in it, and unfortunately, I think that's the ultimate demise of it. And so then I joined Slash's band because Brian Tichy was playing and they needed a quick replacement to go touring. And then after that, Zach had called me up because he was doing the Book of Shadows record. And he was talking with the producers, can't remember their names, wonderful guys, and he said, you know, this kind of music, James is the guy for it. And, you know, he just brought me in to do that. And I love that record. That's my favorite record. Stepping out and being a Zakk Wylde fan, that's my favorite record that he's done.
Me too. Yeah, for sure. And then as if your career, like, that's not even, you then go and join. And to me, this was so crazy that you went into Megadeth, only because when people think of Megadeth, at least if you're a fan and I am, I think about Dave and Dave. I think about Junior, Dave Ellefson. And many people don't remember that there was this moment. It was many years where Junior, Dave Ellefson wasn't in the band and you were the guy. What was going on there, and what was your level of comfort knowing a bit about the sort of character we hear about Dave Mustaine, at least in the media and people talk about, and also filling the shoes of somebody who was essentially his partner the whole way through?
Well, those are two interesting questions. Here's the thing, okay? I kind of got this rap throughout the industry that I could get along with people. Like, I'm truly difficult people. So Dave obviously had that rap, right? A friend of mine, Alan Steelgrave, worked over at ESP at the time. He was, that was Dave's guitar company at the time. So he was liaisoning this, and he calls me up, and I needed work. I was sitting at home trying to figure out what the next move would be. And so the phone rings, and there's Alan, and he goes, I've got a band for you. It's one of the big metal bands. I said, so it's not Metallica because Trujillo's in that. And he goes, so I can't tell you who it is, but just get a package together. And I was like, what do I send? You know, all my stuff's kind of middle of the road rock stuff, really. So I did have a band with Ray Luzier. We called it the Hideous Sun Demons. And there was a heavy track on there called The Mummy, which actually played on a 6-string bass. And it was pretty dexterous. So I thought, that's kind of almost there. So I put that together with a couple of the more famous things that I had done, something I'd done on an Ozzy record, and sent that off. And a couple of days later, it's Dave on the phone. And he goes, really, really, I listened to everything you sent me. I think you're a great bass player. I would love you to try out. And so I got together with him, and we played some songs together. And it was that simple. He was just like, okay, we're going to Dubai in 3 weeks, so we're going to rehearse in a week. And now I had like some 20-odd songs to Megadeth songs to learn. And Mitch, I did not know a lot of these songs. I was not a Megadeth fan. Not saying I didn't like their music, but I knew the hits because I had a career. I had other stuff I was doing, you know, while they were coming up. So getting into this, I didn't have time to think about, you know, who I was replacing, you know, Dave Ellison, but I got to be a real fan of his learning the stuff because I got to hear a lot of the, Dave sent me some of the studio stuff where it was just kind of stripped out so I could really hear the bass parts well. And that was exciting because that's like being a fly on the wall in the studio, you know. So I did that and got it together. And, you know, first gig was off in Dubai. And I always approached it like, I'm not trying to fill his shoes. I'm trying to do a good job and make it sound as Megadethy as I possibly can, which meant to try and, you know, cop more of the way that Dave would play stuff. You know, you can't betray yourself completely. You have to do what you do. So, you know, the question came up, will you play with a pick? Will you play with your fingers? And I was like, I made the decision straight away. This has got to be done with a pick, just because it just won't register the same way. And that's when I moved to bolt-on necks from neck through basses that I was using, because I thought that would have more concussion to it, like the older records that they were doing. And, you know, I took it very seriously and very profoundly and respectfully. Now, getting to the point, Dave was wonderful. To this day, we're friends. I think he's a great guy. I mean, so something people don't realize about people like Dave is he's driven, he's focused, he knows exactly what he wants, and that's basically how you make great bands like Megadeth. Yeah. And most of the guys I've worked with who are really successful, they all share what Dave has, that focus. And so, you know, I'm still a fan of his. I was honored to be part of that band and carry the legacy for a couple of albums and a bunch of tours. And Megadeth fans, I don't have to say because I'm not in the band anymore, but I will tell you, they are the best fans. They live for that band.
I'm really curious about how you see White Lion upon reflection, because I'm thinking about how you just explained the Dave Mustaine thing, and I'm sure you didn't include White Lion in that package, but I'm sure Dave must have known that at one point you were in White Lion. Black Label Society, Zakk Wylde, being in heavier bands. Do you look back on it with like a lot of sort of thanks and what an amazing time it was, great, or do you look back on it and almost want to hide it? And I say that from a place of total respect, meaning I do know a lot of players from that time who sort of hide the fact that they were in that sort of 80s genre. How do you see it for yourself, or do you not care? Do you tell people I'm the guy from White Lion, or
I can't use that anymore because most of the people I meet are young, so they don't know, you know. But when I meet old people, respectfully, for a long time, I have to say there was a stigma to the whole hair band thing, and yeah. I understand completely why. I got out the back door, Mitch. I honestly did. I see it. I can see it in my head. I just opened that kitchen door and walked out the back of the house and didn't worry about it because we had our success and that genre of music just dissipated. We did everything we could to make the music as good as we possibly can. Vito and Mike had a lot more control over the music than I did, so it was somewhat stifling to me. That might come as a surprise, you know. So there was, you know, there's those little intra-band frustrations there. So I didn't miss that part of it so much. I did like being in a successful band. I did like Mike. I did like Vito. I did like Greg. So, you know, the family that we had. But I realized that musically I had much further to go. And I always looked at joining that band as like taking a step aside of my truer musical self. And that's not to take a note away from that band. We made great music. But from James Lomenzo's Happy Place, I've always played a more freeform blues-oriented music. So when I got out of there and I met with Zakk and we started making that total freeform stuff, that was my happy place. That was what made the most sense to me. Having said that, there was a time in the 90s where, you know, it was, you almost looked on as being silly for being one of those bands. And I hit both ends of that spectrum. I'd meet people who would kind of make fun of it. And I deal with it, whatever, you know, that's what I did. I sold millions of records, bought houses, the whole nine yards. And did you do that? You know, that sort of thing. I worked hard at that. And then I met fans, and I would always try and prop up whatever their memory of the thing was and try and make it better for them. Because I realized, being a fan of music in the 60s, when I met my heroes, when I met John Fogerty and stuff like that, that is my life. That musical palette that I grew up in, that stuff is what gave me wings, what made me stand up, and what gave me, you know, the joy of my life. And, you know, why would I hide that or take that away from somebody else, you know, who's really into that sort of thing?
Do we know, and it's just because I'm thinking that now, I hadn't thought about it, what happened with Vito? I mean, this, and the reason I'm asking this question actually is because as you're saying it, I'm like, yeah, I really do feel like that genre got an unfair rap, not only because I loved it and you want to hold on to the things you loved as someone who was developing in music at that time, but the players were astonishing. The singers were amazing. The drummers were killer. The bass was...
Vito was a fantastic guitar player, man. I'll give him that any day.
But I haven't... Like, what happened? Did he, when you talk about leaving, like walking out that kitchen door, did he like not even, did he just Does he play any? Does anyone know?
I've reached out and contacted him. I've asked years ago. There were some offers on the table. He's just not interested. And you know what? I'm going to respect that because I think that I'm not. These are my words, not his. I think that you know he's happy with the legacy of it. I don't think he really wants to even challenge that. You know, and you know, there is a certain music's great. You get on stage, you make people happy. That's the best of it. It's hard, man. I mean, this kind of lifestyle, the travel, leaving your family behind, you know, I'm married, I have a daughter, you know, you leave the family behind, you know, there's all these things that go into it. I know that, you know, Vito had some aging parents he was looking after. So, you know, you have to decide where your priorities are and how you can balance them. And it's not for everybody, you know, so, everybody sees us on stage.
I was going to say, it just becomes a bit of a somewhat of a tragedy for me as a fan because he was such a crazy amazing player that it's like you sort of want artists to always produce. Like that's just as a fan, you know.
I know, but I think it's kind of cool that you know he's got the brass to go. Nah, I did it. I'm done.
Yeah, mind blowing to me. I'm blind to me. Last.
But I'm not that animal. All the other people I know, like George Lynch, he'll never stop playing. That guy's amazing, and he gets better and better and better every time I see him.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, there's some of us have that drive, and some of us don't need it, and that's it's all good.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many other artists you played with and done amazing things with. I can't thank you enough for your time, James. I'm curious before we get going, just so what is life like now? You're with John Fogerty. What other stuff are you doing? I know for a while you were doing graphic design too. You've got this Monster House Productions. Like, what's your life like beyond when you get fly-ins and gigs with John Fogerty or tours?
Well, I've expanded a little right now, and I've just been doing so many wonderful things. Coming up and playing like this Kings of Chaos thing with Dee Snider.
Right.
Speaking of the 80s with Dee Snider and Sebastian Bach and Gilby Clark and Warren DeMartini, who I've always wanted to play with, by the way. I've never had the opportunity.
From Rat.
And of course, our favorite drummer, Kenny Aronoff. And so like things like that keep popping up. I'm going back to over... Where are we going? We're going over to Russia and Dubai with that Hail Band, which is the all-star four-piece metal thing that I did many years ago, which is great because
Tim,
we go to the small...
Tim Ripper Owens, right?
It was with Tim. Yeah. It's going to be with somebody else this time. It's
oh, cool.
It's always it's an ever-changing cast of characters, but that is the greatest experience anybody can have because you just basically put a bag over your shoulder, a guitar over your shoulder, and you just show up at these clubs in the middle of nowhere and everybody comes out and you get to meet these fans who never in their life thought they would meet you, let alone see you, you know, play the music that they love for them close and personal. So it's things like that. I get a lot of those kind of calls. I do an awful lot of recording for people over the internet, which I love doing. And if anybody is interested in that, you can reach me at monsterhouseprod at gmail.com. That's monsterhouse prod at gmail.com. And I love to do those things. So hit me there. And that's pretty much it. And we got plenty of gigging going on. We got the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, and John is we're playing at the Bethel Woods, the actual Woodstock location. And I still don't know if they're doing that big Woodstock show, but we're rolling along, bitch.
That's great. Hey, James, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this. It's really nice talking with you, man.